of ourselves that is reflected back. This is the opposite of Christian love. The opposite is all about me, even idolizing my beloved. Certainly a danger for the newly infatuated, is all about me. Though it pretends to be all about the other, it is all about me because it does not take my beloved seriously as a person, created and redeemed by God, but rather imagines him to be perfect, heroic, sublime, and customized to meet my needs. The fact that these infatuations can pass and become hostile and bitter so quickly shows that the comprehensive attraction and love was never really there. So often today's relationships careen from each person being blind to one another's serious flaws to being angry, disillusioned, and blind to one another's strengths. What can you do? In counseling with many young adults today, I often hear them insist that it is unwise to marry someone before you have lived with them for a couple of years. They are incredulous when I point out what we saw in earlier chapters, namely, that statistics show that people who have lived together before marriage are more likely to get a divorce. But dating today is basically nothing but a round of entertainment venues and sexual encounters. I have come to realize that many turn to cohabitation because they have no other way to get into the other person's everyday life enough to assess their character. When two Christians participate together in the same Christian community, however, there are plenty of opportunities to enter the worlds of one another in the older way. By serving the poor, or going to Bible study and fellowship groups, or attending worship, you can come into each other's front porches and parlors in a way that is difficult outside a community of faith. One of the ways you can judge whether you have moved past the infatuation stage is to ask a set of questions. Have you been through and solved a few sharp conflicts? Have you been through a cycle of repenting and forgiving? Have each of you shown the other that you can make changes out of love for the other? Two kinds of couples answer no. The first kind are those who never have any conflicts. It may be they are not past infatuation. The second kind of couple has had a stormy relationship and has the same unresolved fights over and over again. They haven't learned even the rudimentary skills of repentance, forgiveness, and change. Neither of these couples may be ready for marriage. One crucial way for you to avoid the blindness and mood swings of becoming too passionate too quickly is to refuse to have sex before you are married. The next chapter is devoted to the Christian reasoning and biblical basis for this ancient sex ethic. But the practical fact is that sexual activity triggers deep passions in you for the other person before you have gotten a good look at him or her. Put friendship development before romantic development. 7. However, also, don't become a faux spouse for someone who won't commit to you. While some couples may get too serious too quickly, there are other couples in which one member in particular has a deep reluctance to move forward and commit to marriage. If a relationship has dragged on for years with no signs of deepening or progressing toward marriage, it may be that one person has found a level of relationship, short of marriage, in which he or she is receiving all that is wanted and feels no need to take it to the final stage of commitment. Kathy and I observed this phenomenon while still in college. We dubbed it the cheap girlfriend syndrome, because it most often was the woman who was interested in marriage while the man was not. Sometimes a man and a woman would spend a great deal of time together. This meant the man had a female companion to accompany him to events, when he wanted one, a woman to talk to, if he felt like talking, and a supportive listener to his troubles, should he need to unburden himself. If the relationship did not involve sex, the man would insist to others that he and the girl weren't even dating, that they weren't involved. If she ever chanced to question this, he might protest, "I never said we were more than friends." But this is unfair, because they were more than friends. He was getting much more than he would out of a male buddy relationship. He was getting many of the perks of marriage without the cost of commitment, while the woman was slowly curling up and dying inside. While congratulating ourselves on this insight, we never thought it would apply to us. However, there came a time in our relationship, after we had known each other for several years, when Kathy saw that this was exactly what had happened. And so, she gave me what has come to be known in our family as the Pearls Before Swine speech. Though we were best friends and kindred spirits, I was still hurting from a previous relationship that had ended badly. Kathy was patient and understanding, up to a point. But the day came when she said, "Look, I can't take this anymore. I have been expecting to be promoted from friend to girlfriend. I know you don't mean to be saying this, but every day you don't choose me to be more than a friend, it feels as if I've been weighed and found wanting. I feel it as a rejection. So I just can't keep going on the same way, hoping that someday you'll want me to be more than a friend. I'm not calling myself a pearl, and I'm not calling you a pig. But one of the reasons Jesus told his disciples not to cast pearls before swine was because a pig can't recognize the value of a pearl. It would seem like just a pebble. If you can't see me as valuable to you, then I'm not going to keep throwing myself into your company, hoping and hoping. I can't do it. The rejection that I perceive, whether you intend it or not, is just too painful." That's exactly what she said. It got my attention. It sent me into a time of deep self-examination. A couple of weeks later, I made the choice. And finally, 8. Get and submit to lots of community input. Older patterns of calling and courtship assumed that friends and relatives would give you major input in the selection of a spouse. Some in newly formed Christian communities are seeking to return to practices that require so much input from families, especially fathers, that they are almost arranged marriages. But even Orthodox Jewish communities know that it is not practicable, especially for single adults who have been away from home for years. In addition, many single Christians have parents who have little understanding of their Christian faith, and therefore would be unhelpful guides. Nevertheless, the basic principle is right and important. Marriage should not be a strictly individual, unilateral decision. It is too important, and our personal perspective is too easily skewed. The community has many married people in it who have much wisdom for single people to hear. Singles should get community input at every step of the way when seeking marriage. In fact, I would suggest something further. The Christian community has a deep investment in you and a deep interest in healthy and happy marriages. Christian marriage should be communal. That is, married Christians should look for ways to share their marriages with the singles and other married couples in their community. Christians are directed to invite one another into their homes, see 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 9, and that doesn't simply mean into their houses. We are to treat one another as members of the same family, according to Romans chapter 12, verse 10, and that means to let people see into our lives. We are called to be transparent before one another. One particular way married people can do that is by displaying the real work of their marriages, not just the sweet, light parts, but the hard, embattled parts to the unmarried. Think of what an impact that would have. Singles must see how hard and how glorious marriage is, not just how satisfying it is. The only way that happens is if married couples share their lives with singles so they can understand what marriage is really like. Marriage is God's gift to the church. Through Christian marriages, the story of the gospel, of sin, grace, and restoration, can be seen and heard both inside the church and out in the world. Christian marriages proclaim the gospel. That is how important they are. The Christian community has a deep interest in the development of strong, great marriages and, therefore, a vested interest in the community's singles marrying well. Singles must not act as if who they marry is a decision belonging just to them as individuals. Chapter 8. Sex and Marriage. For this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 31. We cannot talk about marriage without talking about sex. But the subject of how sex relates to marriage has two levels to it. At the foundational level, we need to understand the basic principle of the biblical sex ethic. Why does God confine sexual activity exclusively to married couples? Then, once we understand and receive the biblical reasoning, how do we live practically in accordance with it as Christians, whether as single persons or as married couples? Sex is just an appetite. No, it's not note. Historically, there have been countless attitudes about sex. First, there is sex as a natural appetite. This view goes something like this. Sex, it is said, was once surrounded by taboos, but now we realize that sex is indeed like eating or like any other good and natural appetite. That means we should feel free to fulfill the appetite when we feel the need. There is no reason why we shouldn't sample a variety of cuisines and continually look for new taste sensations. Forbidding the satisfaction of a natural appetite or limiting it for years is as unhealthy and really as impossible as trying to stop eating for years. Another view of sex is more negative, and it has deep roots in some forms of ancient thought. Sex is seen as part of our lower physical nature, distinct from our higher rational, more spiritual nature. In this view, sex is a degrading, dirty thing, a necessary evil for the propagation of the human race. This view is still very influential in the world. Today, a third view is also prominent. While the first view sees sex as an unavoidable drive, and the second as a necessary evil, this last view sees sex as a critical form of self-expression, a way to be yourself and find yourself. In this view, the individual may wish to use sex within marriage and to build a family, but that is up to the individual. Sex is primarily for an individual's fulfillment and self-realization, however he or she wishes to pursue it. The biblical attitude towards sex is popularly thought to be the second view, sex as demeaning and dirty. But it is most definitely not. It differs quite radically from each of these other understandings. Is sex just an appetite? Yes, it is an appetite, but it is not in the same category as our needs for food and sleep. Indeed, even those desires cannot simply be gratified, whatever their level of intensity. Most people struggle to discipline their eating because their appetite for food is seriously out of line with what their bodies really need. The sex drive, however, needs even more guidance. Sex affects our heart, our inward being, not just our body. Sin, which is first and foremost a disorder of the heart, therefore has a big impact on sex. Our passions and desires for sex now are very distorted. Sex is for whole life self-giving. However, the sinful heart wants to use sex for selfish reasons, not self-giving. And therefore the Bible puts many rules around it to direct us to use it in the right way. The Christian sex ethic can be summarized like this. Sex is for use within marriage between a man and woman. Sex is dirty. No, it's not. Is sex dirty and demeaning, as others have said? No. Biblical Christianity may be the most body-positive religion in the world. It teaches that God made matter and physical bodies and saw that it was all good. See Genesis chapter 1, verse 31. It says that in Jesus Christ, God himself actually took on a human body, which he still has in glorified form, and that someday he is going to give us all perfect resurrected bodies. It says that God created sexuality and gave a woman and man to each other in the beginning. The Bible contains great love poetry that celebrates sexual passion and pleasure. If anyone says that sex is bad or dirty in itself, we have the entire Bible to contradict him. God not only allows sex within marriage, but strongly commands it. See 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 3, 4, and 5. In the book of Proverbs, husbands are encouraged to let their wives' breasts fill them with delight and be intoxicated by their sexual love. See Proverbs chapter 5, verse 19, and compare Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 5. The book Song of Solomon does much barefaced rejoicing in the delights of sexual love and marriage. Old Testament scholar Tremper Longman writes, "The role of the woman throughout the Song of Solomon is truly astounding, especially in light of its ancient origins. It is the woman, not the man, who is the dominant voice throughout the poems that make up the song. She is the one who seeks, pursues, initiates." In Song, chapter 5, verses 10 through 16, she boldly exclaims her physical attraction. "His abdomen is like a polished ivory tusk, decorated with sapphires." Verse 14. Most English translations hesitate in this verse. The Hebrew is quite erotic, and most translators cannot bring themselves to bring out the obvious meaning. This is a prelude to their lovemaking. There is no shy, shamed, mechanical movement under the sheets. Rather, the two stand before each other, aroused, feeling no shame, but only joy in each other's sexuality. The Bible is a very uncomfortable book for the prudish. Sex is strictly a private matter. No, it's not. Is sex, however, primarily a means of individual happiness and fulfillment? No. But that doesn't mean that sex is not about joy, or that it is only about duty. The Christian teaching is that sex is primarily a way to know God and build community, and if you use it for those things rather than for your own personal satisfaction, it will lead to greater fulfillment than you can imagine. The first explicit mention of sex in the Bible is in the famous passage, Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, quoted also by Paul in Ephesians chapter 5. "Male and female are to be united, to become one flesh." When first reading this phrase in English, it appears to be talking only about physical, sexual union. But while the words do not mean less than that, they mean much more. When the Bible says that all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth, see Genesis chapter 6, verse 12, or that God would pour out his Spirit on all flesh, see Joel chapter 2, verse 28, it did not mean that only bodies were sinning, or that God was giving his Spirit to all bodies. Rather, he was giving his Spirit to all people. Flesh is a synecdoche, a figure of speech in which a part of a thing is used to represent the whole, as in our phrase, counting noses. In other words, marriage is a union between two people so profound that they virtually become a new single person. The word united, in older translations to cleave, means to make a binding covenant or contract. This covenant brings every aspect of two persons' lives together. They essentially merge into a single legal, social, economic unit. They lose much of their independence. In love, they donate themselves wholly to the other. To call the marriage one flesh, then, means that sex is understood as both a sign of that personal, legal union and a means to accomplish it. The Bible says don't unite with someone physically unless you are also willing to unite with the person emotionally, personally, socially, economically, and legally. Don't become physically naked and vulnerable to the other person without becoming vulnerable in every other way, because you have given up your freedom and bound yourself in marriage. Then, once you have given yourself in marriage, sex is a way of maintaining and deepening that union as the years go by. In the Old Testament, there were often covenant renewal ceremonies. When God entered into a covenant relationship with his people, he directed that periodically there would be an opportunity to have them remember the terms of the covenant by first reading it together and then recommitting themselves to it. This was crucial if the people were to sustain a life of faithfulness. It is the same with the marriage covenant. When you get married, you make a solemn covenant with your spouse. The Bible calls your spouse your covenant partner. See Proverbs chapter 2, verse 17. That day is a great day, and your hearts are full. But as time goes on, there is a need to rekindle the heart and renew the commitment. There must be an opportunity to recall all that the other person means to you and to give yourself anew. Sex between a husband and a wife is the unique way to do that. Indeed, sex is perhaps the most powerful God-created way to help you give your entire self to another human being. Sex is God's appointed way for two people to reciprocally say to one another, "I belong completely, permanently, and exclusively to you." You must not use sex to say anything less. So, according to the Bible, a covenant is necessary for sex. It creates a place of security for vulnerability and intimacy. But though a marriage covenant is necessary for sex, sex is also necessary for the maintenance of the covenant. It is your covenant renewal service. Sex is a uniting act. One biblical author who is popularly thought to have a negative view of sex is St. Paul. Yet a closer look at what Paul actually says makes that hard to support. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 17, Paul forbids Christians from having sex with a prostitute, but the reasoning he gives is remarkable. "Do you not know that a person who is united in intimacy with a prostitute is one body with her? For, as it is said, the two shall become one flesh. Keep away from sexual immorality, for you do not belong to yourselves. You were bought with a price. Show forth God's glory, then, in how you live your bodily life." 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 17, 18, and 20. What does this mean? Clearly, one flesh means something different to Paul than mere sexual union, or Paul would be reciting a mere tautology. "Don't you know that when you have physical union with a prostitute, you are having physical union with a prostitute?" Obviously, Paul also understands becoming one flesh here to mean becoming one person. One flesh refers to the personal union of a man and woman at all levels of their lives. Paul then is decrying the monstrosity of physical oneness without all the other kinds of oneness that every sex act should mirror. D.S. Bailey, who wrote the magisterial The Man-Woman Relation in Christian Thought, argues how groundbreaking and unprecedented the New Testament and Pauline view of sex was in the history of human thought. He writes, "Here, Paul's thought owes nothing to any antecedent notions, and displays a psychological insight into human sexuality which is altogether exceptional by first century standards. The apostle denies that coitus is no more than an appropriate exercise of the genital organs. On the contrary, he insists that it is an act which engages and expresses the whole personality in such a way as to constitute a unique mode of self-disclosure and self-commitment." In short, according to Paul, sex with a prostitute is wrong because every sex act is supposed to be a uniting act. Paul insists it is radically dissonant to give your body to someone to whom you will not also commit your whole life. C.S. Lewis likened sex without marriage to tasting food without swallowing and digesting. The analogy is apt. Sex as a commitment apparatus. The modern sexual revolution finds the idea of abstinence from sex till marriage to be so unrealistic as to be ludicrous. In fact, many people believe it is psychologically unhealthy and harmful. Yet despite the contemporary incredulity, this has been the unquestioned, uniform teaching of not only one but all of the Christian churches, Orthodox, Catholic, and Protestant. The Bible does not counsel sexual abstinence before marriage because it has such a low view of sex, but because it has such a lofty one. The biblical view implies that sex outside of marriage is not just morally wrong, but also personally harmful. If sex is designed to be part of making a covenant and experiencing that covenant's renewal, then we should think of sex as an emotional commitment apparatus. If sex is a method that God invented to do whole life entrustment and self-giving, it should not surprise us that sex makes us feel deeply connected to the other person, even when used wrongly. Unless you deliberately disable it, or through practice you numb the original impulse, sex makes you feel personally interwoven and joined to another human being, as you are literally, physically joined. In the midst of sexual passion, you naturally want to say extravagant things such as, "I'll always love you." Even if you are not legally married, you may find yourself very quickly feeling marriage-like ties, feeling that the other person has obligations to you. But that other person has no legal, social, or moral responsibility even to call you back in the morning. This incongruity leads to jealousy and hurt feelings and obsessiveness if two people are having sex but are not married. It makes breaking up vastly harder than it should be. It leads many people to stay trapped in relationships that are not good because of a feeling of having somehow connected themselves. Therefore, if you have sex outside marriage, you will have to steel yourself against sex's power to soften your heart toward another person and make you more trusting. The problem is that eventually sex will lose its covenant-making power for you, even if one day you do get married. Ironically, then, sex outside of marriage eventually works backwards, making you less able to commit and trust another person. Practical chastity. What if you decide that, as a single person, you are going to adopt the Christian ethic and practice chastity? Certainly that will be difficult, especially in a culture that gives you no support for your conviction. But you can be successful if you rely on the following resources. First, you need the spousal love of Jesus in your life. Sex is for fully committed relationships because it is a foretaste of the joy that comes from being in complete union with God through Christ. The most rapturous love between a man and woman on earth is only a hint of what it is like. See Romans chapter 7, verses 1 through 6, and Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22. Knowing this helps a lot. One reason we can burn with seemingly uncontrollable sexual passion is because at the moment our hearts believe the lie that if we have a great romantic sexual experience, we will finally feel deeply fulfilled. To resist temptation, we have to speak the truth to our hearts. We must remind them that sex simply cannot fill the cosmic need for closure that our souls seek in romance. Only meeting Christ face to face will fill the emptiness in our hearts that sin created when we lost our unbroken fellowship with Him. But we are not simply called to wait for an experience of Christ's full love in the future. The Bible tells us that we can have not just intellectual belief in this love, but actual experience of it now. See Romans chapter 5, verse 5, and Ephesians chapter 3, verse 17. This is available through prayer. Also, to walk this path, single people need a Christian community. They should live in a community with other singles, who are neither too hungry to be married nor too fearful of it. They should be in a community with singles who don't use the world's standards, physical beauty and wealth, as a basis for making partner choices. It would additionally be important for singles to live in community with Christian families who do not make family an idol, nor make singles feel superfluous. Another mark of this community should be free and open discussion about how the Bible's perspective on sex plays out in life and relationships. The more often singles and married Christians reflect on the biblical teaching about this, the more support singles will feel for abiding by it. Most of all, singles who want romantic involvement without mandatory sexual intercourse will need a sufficiently large community of single people who are all pursuing the same goal. Some will hear the last two paragraphs and exclaim, "But there aren't any churches like that." That is largely true. And as a pastor, I freely confess that my own church goes through cycles in which it serves singles well, but it has more often failed to provide the kind of community described. I want to challenge listeners to take it upon themselves to create those conditions in their churches, or start some new churches that make such community a priority. Finally, strike a balance with regard to your sexual thoughts and desires. Some Christians feel deeply stained and defiled by any strong sexual thoughts or daydreams. Others indulge in them. The gospel is neither legalism nor antinomianism. Christians are not saved by obeying God, and yet true salvation will lead to obeying God out of gratitude. This should lead to a very balanced approach to thoughts and temptations. Martin Luther, for example, was reputed to say about sexual desires, "You can't stop birds from flying over your head, but you can stop them from making nests in your hair." By that he meant that we can't stop sexual thoughts from occurring to us. They are natural and unavoidable. However, we are responsible for what we do with those thoughts. We must not entertain and dwell on them. And if we do something sexually that is wrong, we should use the gospel of grace on our consciences. That gospel will neither take the sin lightly nor lead you to flagellate yourself and wallow in guilt indefinitely. It is important to get the gospel's pardon and cleansing for wrongdoing. Often it is unresolved shame for past offenses that stir up present obsessive fantasies. The inner dialogue. Ultimately, it is not techniques that will enable single Christians to practice the Christian sex ethic. It will take conviction. In the classic novel Jane Eyre, Jane has fallen in love with Mr. Rochester, but she has also learned that he is married and that his mentally ill wife lives in an upper room in his estate. Nevertheless, he urges her to live with him as his mistress. This touches off an inner storm, an enormous conflict in her heart. "While he spoke, my very conscience and reason turned traitors against me, and charged me with crime in resisting him. They spoke almost as loud as feeling, and that clamored wildly, 'Oh, comply,' it said. 'Think of his misery, think of his danger, look at his state when left alone. Remember his headlong nature, consider the recklessness following on despair. Soothe him, save him, love him. Tell him you love him and will be his. Who in the world cares for you, or who will be injured by what you do?'" Jane discerns different rooms or faculties in her soul. There is conscience, there is reason, and there is feeling. And they all rise up and argue that they should do what Mr. Rochester asks. He is lonely and miserable. She should comfort him. He is rich and adores her. After a life of hardship, surely she deserves this. But she resists what they all say. Still indomitable was the reply. "I care for myself. The more solitary, the more friendless, the more unsustained I am, the more I will respect myself. I will keep the law given by God, sanctioned by man. I will hold to the principles received by me when I was sane, and not mad, as I am now. Laws and principles are not for the times when there is no temptation. They are for such moments as this, when body and soul rise in mutiny against their rigor. Stringent are they, inviolate they shall be. If at my individual convenience I might break them, what would be their worth? They have a worth, so I have always believed. And if I cannot believe it now, it is because I am insane, quite insane. With my veins running fire, and my heart beating faster than I can count its throbs. Preconceived opinions, foregone determinations, are all I have at this hour to stand by. There, I plant my foot. I did. Jane Eyre has been made into a movie or TV show many times, and as far as I know, when this scene comes and Mr. Rochester makes his powerful plea, none of this inner dialogue is ever depicted. We hear Jane resisting only by saying things like, "I will respect myself." Modern viewers are therefore likely left with the illusion that Jane was able to resist temptation simply out of an effort to keep high self-esteem. She appears to be saying not that being Mr. Rochester's mistress would be immoral, but that it would be demeaning. All the movie versions I have seen give the impression that she looks inside and finds the inner self-assurance and self-respect to refuse a second-class position. But see how she actually does resist? She does not look into her heart for strength. There's nothing there but clamorous conflict. She ignores what her heart says and looks to what God says. The moral laws of God, at that very moment, made no sense to her heart and mind at all. They did not appear reasonable, and they did not appear fair. But, she says, if she could break them when they appear inconvenient to her, of what would be their worth? If you only obey God's word when it seems reasonable or profitable to you, well, that isn't really obedience at all. Obedience means you cede someone an authority over you that is there even when you don't agree with him. God's law is four times of temptation, when body and soul rise in mutiny against their rigor. On God's word, then, not her feelings and passions, she plants her foot. I've never seen anywhere a more clear or eloquent example of what a Christian single person's inner dialogue should be with regard to temptation. Learn how to plant your foot. The importance of erotic love in marriage. Since the Bible confines sex to marriage, we should not be surprised to find that various passages instruct married couples to enjoy sex and do so frequently. We have already mentioned the eye-opening passages from the Song of Solomon and Proverbs chapter 5, verse 19, which exhort husbands to be delighted with their wives' bodies. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 3, 4, and 5, Paul speaks with surprising candor about the importance and realities of marital sexual relations. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Do not deprive each other except by mutual consent and for a time. Here, at a time in which women were legally considered the possessions of their husbands, Paul makes the revolutionary claim that the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. It communicates negatively his obligation to refrain from engaging in sexual relations with anyone other than his wife, and positively his obligation to fulfill his marital duty to provide her with sexual pleasure and satisfaction. This was a major blow to the traditional double standard, namely that men were expected and allowed to have multiple sexual partners, but if a woman did, she was despised. Paired with the previous statement that the wife's body also belongs to her husband, Paul was teaching that each partner, male and female, had the right to mutual sexual relations. Nothing like this had ever been said before. Modern readers will find this text satisfying because of our contemporary Western view of human rights, but that is not Paul's main point at all. He is giving us a remarkably positive view of sexual satisfaction within marriage. The view of the Roman culture in which the Corinthian Christians lived was that Men were to take wives in order to have legal heirs, while sexual pleasure, if it was to be sought at all, would typically be found outside the marriage. Historians point out, however, that Paul in effect redefines marriage as a context for the mutual satisfying of erotic desires in contrast to the pagan philosophical idea that the purpose of marriage was the procreation of legitimate heirs who would inherit and continue the name, property, and sacred rights of the family. In other words, Paul is telling married Christians that mutual, satisfying sexual relations must be an important part of their life together. In fact, this passage indicates that sex should be frequent and reciprocal. One spouse was not allowed to deny sex to the other. The erotic marriage. I believe this particular part of 1 Corinthians chapter 7 is an important practical resource. Each partner in marriage is to be most concerned not with getting sexual pleasure, but with giving it. In short, the greatest sexual pleasure should be the pleasure of seeing your spouse getting pleasure. When you get to the place where giving arousal is the most arousing thing, you are practicing this principle. When I was doing research for this chapter, I found some old talks that Kathy and I did together. I had forgotten some of the struggles we had in our early days, and some of the notes reminded me that in those years we started to dread having sex. Kathy, in those remarks, said that if she didn't experience an orgasm during lovemaking, we both felt like failures. If I asked her, "How was that?" and she said, "It just hurt," I felt devastated, and she did too. We had a great deal of trouble until we started to see something. As Kathy said in her notes, we came to realize that orgasm is great, especially climaxing together. But the awe, the wonder, the safety, and the joy of just being one is stirring and stunning even without that. And when we stopped trying to perform and just started trying to simply love one another in sex, things started to move ahead. We stopped worrying about our performance, and we stopped worrying about what we were getting and started to say, "Well, what can we do just to give something to the other?" This concept also has implications for a typical problem that many couples experience in their marital relationship, namely, that one person wants sex more often than the other. If your main purpose in sex is giving pleasure, not getting pleasure, then a person who doesn't have much of a sex drive, physically, can give to the other person as a gift. This is a legitimate act of love, and it shouldn't be denigrated by saying, "Oh, no, no, unless you're going to be all passionate, don't do it." Do it as a gift. Related to this are the differences that many spouses experience over what is the most satisfying context for sex. While I am not saying this is universal, I will share that, as a male, context means very little to me. That means, to be blunt, pretty much any time, anywhere. However, I came to see that that meant I was being oblivious to something that was very important to my wife. Context? Oh, you mean candles or something? And of course, Kathy, like so many women, did not mean candles or something. She meant preparing for sex emotionally. She meant warmth and conversation and things like that. I learned this too, but slowly. And so we learned to be very patient with each other when it came to sex. It took years for us to be good at sexually satisfying one another, but the patience paid off. Sex as a test. The Bible gives us a high view of sex. It is a sign and seal of our oneness with each other and with God. We should not then be surprised to discover that you may find problems showing up in bed, which, if it wasn't for sex, you might never have seen. There may be guilt, fear, or anger over past relationships. There may be growing mistrust or disrespect or unresolved differences in your present relationship. Sex is such a great and sensitive thing that you will not be able to sweep these problems under the rug. Unless your marital relationship is in a good condition, sex doesn't work. So be very careful to look beneath the surface. A lack of sexual compatibility might not really be a lack of lovemaking skill at all. It may be a sign of deeper problems in the relationship. It is often the case that, if those problems are addressed, the sexual intimacy improves. A fundamental rule of marriage is that time marches on. And as Lewis Smeads said, you don't marry one woman or one man, but many. Time, children, illness, and age all bring changes that may require creative, disciplined responses to rebuild a sexual intimacy that was easier at an earlier time. If you don't confront and adapt to these changes, they'll erode your sex life. Kathy and I often liken sex in a marriage to oil in an engine. Without it, the friction between all the moving parts will burn out the motor. Without joyful, loving sex, the friction in a marriage will bring about anger, resentment, hardness, and disappointment. Rather than being the commitment glue that holds you together, it can become a force to divide you. Never give up working on your sex life. The glory of sex. Sex is glorious. We would know that even if we didn't have the Bible. Sex leads us to words of adoration. It literally evokes shouts of joy and praise. Through the Bible, we know why this is true. John chapter 17 tells us that from all eternity, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit have been adoring and glorifying each other, living in high devotion to each other, pouring love and joy into one another's hearts continually. Compare John chapter 1 verse 18 and chapter 17 verses 5, 21, 24, and 25. Sex between a man and a woman points to the love between the Father and the Son. See 1 Corinthians chapter 11 verse 3. It's a reflection of the joyous self-giving and pleasure of love within the very life of the triune God. Sex is glorious not only because it reflects the joy of the Trinity, but also because it points to the eternal delight of soul that we will have in heaven, in our loving relationships with God and one another. Romans chapter 7 verse 1 tells us that the best marriages are pointers to the deep, infinitely fulfilling, and final union we will have with Christ in love. No wonder, as some have said, that sex between a man and a woman can be a sort of embodied, out-of-body experience. It's the most ecstatic, breathtaking, daring, scarcely to be imagined look at the glory that is our future. Epilogue. Marriage does not consist of just one form of human love. It is not merely romantic passion or friendship or acts of duty and service. It is all of these things and more. It is overwhelming. Where do we get the power to meet the seemingly impossible demands of marriage? 17th century Christian poet George Herbert wrote three poems about love, but the most famous was the last, entitled simply, Love, Number 3. Love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. But quick-eyed love, observing me grow slack from my first entrance in, drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning if I lacked anything. A guest, I answered, worthy to be here. Love said, you shall be he. I, the unkind, the ungrateful? Ah, my dear, I cannot look on thee. Love took my hand, and smiling, did reply, who made the eyes but I? Truth, Lord, but I have marred them. Let my shame go where it doth deserve. And know you not, says love, who bore the blame? My dear, then I will serve. You must sit down, says love, and taste my meat. So I did sit and eat. Love welcomes him in, but because of the poet's sense of guilt and sin, he grows slack and shrinks back just inside the doorway. Love notices everything, however. He sees the hesitation and approaches with sweet words, like an innkeeper of old asking, "What do you lack?" The guest answers that he does indeed lack something important, the very worthiness to be loved. His host replies, with realism but confidence, that he intends to bring that worthiness about. He doesn't love the guest because he is lovely, but to make him lovely. Unconvinced, the guest answers back that he can't even look upon love. The mysterious figure reveals then who he is. "I'm the one who made your eyes, you know, and I made them to look upon me." The guest now knows who love is, because he calls him Lord, but he is still without hope. "Just let this wretch depart in shame. But don't you know I bore your blame?" For this, even the guest's deepest fears and doubts have no answer. And so the Lord lovingly but firmly tells him to sit down. And now the Lord of the universe, who humbly washed his disciples' feet, serves the loved, unworthy man at the table. "You must taste my meat." So I did sit and eat. French philosopher, writer, and activist Simone Weil was a Jewish agnostic, but one day in 1938, she was meditating on this poem of George Herbert, and, as she did so, she had an overwhelming, powerful experience of Christ's love. "Christ came down," she wrote about that moment, "and took possession of me." From that time forward, she became a professing Christian. She had not been expecting or seeking such an experience. She had never read any books on mystical experience, and as a Jewish agnostic, she certainly was not looking to Christ for anything like this. And yet, through this poem, Christ's sacrifice on the cross became a reality to her. "In this sudden possession of me by Christ, I felt in the midst of my suffering the presence of a love, like that which one can read on the smile of a beloved face." When we looked at the conversion of Louis Zamperini, and saw how the flood of Christ's love gave him the immediate ability to forgive people who had tortured him for years, we cautioned that spiritual growth doesn't always work like that. We must say the same thing about Simone Weil's experience. Herbert's poem is a masterpiece of spiritual art. It will yield endless insights, and I have personally found that it has worked on my heart powerfully. But if you turn to it for a once-and-for-all spiritual encounter that removes all your doubts and fears, you will probably be disappointed. Nevertheless, at the end of the day, Christ's love is the great foundation for building a marriage that sings. Some who turn to Christ find that his love comes in like a wave that instantly floods the hard ground of their hearts. Others find that his love comes in gently and gradually, like soft rain or even a mist. But in any case, the heart becomes like ground watered by Christ's love, which enables all the forms of human love to grow. Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Whosoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. This is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us, and his love is made complete in us. 1 John, chapter 4, verses 7, 8, 10, and 11.
Appendix: Decision-Making and Gender Roles. Tim and I, Kathy, have used the following principles to guide us in our everyday decisions as well as our more complicated decisions. These five guidelines have proved useful to us, and so I hope they will for you. The husband's authority, like the son's over us, is never used to please himself, but only to serve the interests of his wife. Headship does not mean a husband simply makes all the decisions, nor does it mean he gets his way in every disagreement. Why? Jesus never did anything to please himself. Romans chapter 15, verses 2 and 3. A servant leader must sacrifice his wants and needs to please, and build up his partner. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 21, FF. A wife is never to be merely compliant, but is to use her resources to empower. She is to be her husband's most trusted friend and counselor, as he is hers. Proverbs chapter 2, verse 17. The completion that embracing the other entails involves a lot of give and take. To complement each other means husband and wife need to hear each other out, make their arguments. Completion is hard work and involves loving contention. Proverbs chapter 27, verse 17. With affection. 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 3 through 5. Until you sharpen, enrich, and enhance each other. She must bring every gift and resource that she has to the discussion, and he must, as any wise manager, know when to allow her experience to trump his own, less well-informed opinion. A wife is not to give her husband unconditional obedience. No human being should give any other human being unconditional obedience. As Peter said, we must obey God rather than men. Acts chapter 5, verse 29. In other words, a wife should not obey or aid a husband in doing things that God forbids, such as selling drugs or physically abusing her. If, for example, he beats her, the strong help that a wife should exercise is to love and forgive him in her heart, but to have him arrested. It is never kind or loving to anyone to make it easy for him or her to do wrong. Assuming the role of headship is only done for purposes of ministering to your wife and family. Some say, in the biblical view, both husband and wife are to minister to each other unselfishly. So then what is the difference? It is clear that the son obeys his head, the father, and that we obey our head, the Christ. But how does this authority work out in the context of mutually serving persons equal in dignity and being? The answer is that a head can only overrule his spouse if he is sure that her choice would be destructive to her or to the family. He does not use his headship selfishly, to get his own way about the color of the car they buy, who gets to hold the remote control, and whether he has a night out with the boys or stays home to help with the kids when his wife asks him. This is the area in which the most misunderstanding, on the part of both men and women, has occurred. Some men, unaware or unwilling to assume their servant leader roles, believe that simply being male brings entitlement with it. And women, often the victims of such mistaken understanding, want no part of any teaching that would demote them to inferior status. But in a marriage where there are only two votes, how can a stalemate be broken without someone having to give way? In the vast majority of cases, the stalemate is broken because each will try to give the other his or her pleasure. The wife will try to respect the husband's leadership, and the husband will in turn try to please his wife. If this dynamic is in place, in the course of a healthy biblical marriage, overruling will be rare. But what of a case where both parties cannot agree, but some kind of decision must be made? Someone must have the right to cast the deciding vote, and thus take the greater responsibility for the decision. This should be the place where the one the Bible calls head takes accountability. When it happens, both people submit to their role. Often, an intelligent husband doesn't want this role, and the intelligent wife does. The situation could be chaotic, but here we are called to act out the drama of redemption, where the son voluntarily gives the headship to the father, saying, "Not my will, but thine be done." In the late 1980s, our family was comfortably situated in a very livable suburb of Philadelphia, where Tim held a full-time position as a professor. Then he got an offer to move to New York City to plant a new church. He was excited by the idea, but I was appalled. Raising our three wild boys in Manhattan was unthinkable. Not only that, but almost no one who knew anything about Manhattan thought that the project would be successful. I also knew that this would not be something that Tim would be able to do as a 9-to-5 job. It would absorb the whole family and nearly all of our time. It was clear to me that Tim wanted to take the call, but I had serious doubts that it was the right choice. I expressed my strong doubts to Tim, who responded, "Well, if you don't want to go, then we won't go." However, I replied, "Oh, no, you don't. You aren't putting this decision on me. That's abdication. If you think this is the right thing to do, then exercise your leadership and make the choice. It's your job to break this logjam. It's my job to wrestle with God until I can joyfully support your call. Tim made the decision to come to New York City and plant Redeemer Presbyterian Church. The whole family, my sons included, consider it one of the most truly manly things he ever did, because he was quite scared, but he felt a call from God. At that point, Tim and I were both submitting to roles that we were not perfectly comfortable with, but it is clear that God worked in us and through us when we accepted our gender roles as a gift from the designer of our hearts. Why should the woman submit at times like these? We must reject the traditionalist answer, namely that women are not decisive enough. The fact is that many wives are more decisive than their husbands. So why are women called to this position? As I said, the answer to that question is another question. Why did Christ become the one to give up the authority to the Father? We don't know, but it is a mark of his greatness, not his indecisiveness. Women are called to follow him here. But remember, taking authority properly is just as hard as granting it.
This is Lloyd James. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of The Meaning of Marriage, Facing the Complexities of Commitment with the Wisdom of God, by Timothy Keller and Kathy Keller. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by John McElroy. The Meaning of Marriage is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc. Copyright 2011. All rights reserved. The book, The Meaning of Marriage, is available wherever Dutton adult books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.